Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, this is Tommy. I wanted to take a moment before this episode begins to acknowledge that life in general is a little weird right now. The coronavirus is affecting us all in one way or another, and we're wandering together into some undiscovered territory. Here at WFAE, our staff is working to bring you the latest news and information you need to navigate these uncertain moments. So keep listening and check out our website at WFAE.org for all the latest. But life is not just the virus. It's good to break away now and then and think about other things. So we'll keep bringing you stories and podcasts about all kinds of topics here in the South and around the world. Today's episode of Southbound does touch on the virus a little bit, but it's also about barbecue and grits and other wonderful things. We hope it gives you a little joy and a bit of escape. Y'all take care of one another. Stay safe and stay tuned. Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. You won't see Hannah Raskin's face on our webpage for this episode. She tries to keep it hidden for her job, but her words alone have made her one of the most important names in the Southern food world, especially in her home of Charleston. She's a restaurant critic and food writer for the Charleston Post and Courier, and in those dual roles, she has charmed readers and ticked off a few chefs. But everything she writes comes from doing her homework, and beyond that, a deep curiosity about Southern food and what it means. Here's our conversation. Hannah Raskin, you just took a journey all over South Carolina, tracking down the elusive barbecue hash. First of all, could you explain what that is for people who might not know?
Yes. I know the word hash puts different pictures in different people's minds. And
yes,
oftentimes,
it's not that kind of hash.
It's not that kind of hash. No, this was a sanctioned trip, so to speak, by my newspaper. So the kind of hash we're talking about is pretty unique to South Carolina. There are parts of Georgia where you can get it as well. What we're talking about in the most basic definition is subprimal pork. Cooked down with liquid spices, some kind of seasoning. It's then all kind of it's simmered for a long time, long cooked dish, and then it's all chopped up and typically served over rice.
And when you say subprimal, you're talking about spare parts, right?
That's
liver,
right.
Kidneys.
Yes. That's the traditional hash.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And did you find that there's still a lot of that out there?
There is a good amount of it. And I should say I did not attempt to cover the entire state. Jim Roller, who does DestinationBarbecue.com, he was kind enough to produce a list for me of every place in the state that has hash on its menu or at least claims to. And that ran 112 places long. So I decided to confine my search to sort of the traditional rice area, which for me meant it was the area bounded by 95 and the coast.
Right.
Yes.
And this kind of stuff, I guess, for people in other states, it's the same kind of stuff you would put into, I guess, like liver mush in North Carolina, which is the same kind of stuff, except they add cornmeal and make kind of a loaf out of it. There's scrapple and things in other parts of the country. It's kind of it's in that vein, right?
Absolutely. It's really, I mean, this is, you know, it's affordable food. So it's, you're taking pork and kind of whatever starch you have around, as you say. So it might be corn in one region. Here, it was traditionally rice.
And it's an acquired taste.
I acquired it pretty quick, but I understand too, some people never acquire it. So.
Yeah, there's a big liver mush divide in my household.
Oh, right,
I'm pro, and my wife is most definitely con.
Oh, my husband wouldn't even look at the pictures I took of hash.
So why did you think that story was important?
So it struck me, and this is actually where, as you know, this sometimes happens, that what brings you into the story, you realize is what's going to bring other people into the story, too. So when I wrote the story, I ended up starting where my thinking began, which is at Rodney Scott's Barbecue, who is probably currently our state's most famous pitmaster, although not historically so, but of the contemporary pitmasters. So Rodney Scott is expanding at a quick rate. Folks may know he got started in Hemingway, opened in Charleston, and has since opened in Birmingham, in Atlanta, and is talking about opening in other places. And part of his story is that he is spreading the love of South Carolina barbecue and all that goes with it. Traditionally, what goes with South Carolina barbecue is hash, but hash is not on the Rodney Scott menu. And so it was curious to me that he is going out with the South Carolina message minus hash.
It's interesting when you said that he is sort of the modern barbecue icon or whatever, however you phrased it, yeah, in South Carolina, because as I'm sure you know, probably the barbecue icon before him was Maurice Bessinger.
I was just, as I said it when I paused, yeah, and I thought, couldn't have two more polar opposites.
Right. And yeah, and so Maurice, for those of you who don't know, ran a chain of barbecue places called Piggy Parks in Columbia and thereabouts for many years, and was, I guess, an avowed white supremacist, and used to keep tracts and booklets in his restaurants talking about how slaves were happy and all that sort of thing. Very controversial figure in South Carolina. And I wonder if, you know, off the top of your head, if you feel like the evolution from Maurice Bessinger to Rodney Scott says anything about the evolution of South Carolina or the South in general.
Interesting. I mean, I don't want to say anything that would suggest I'm equating hash with racism. Like what I'm right. What I'm about to say is that I think it's progress in the right direction. What I love about Rodney Scott's restaurant here in Charleston is, it is one of the most integrated eating places we have, which is really, really exciting to see. Almost never in Charleston proper do you see a mixed group of diners. So this really, in some ways, I mean, it is the answer to and counterbalance to the bigotry of Maurice Bessinger.
I don't want to let you go on barbecue without asking your opinion on mustard sauce.
I like it.
I mean, too.
Yeah, I really like it. I do. Yeah, I mean, anything that's going to give a little extra tang, I enjoy it.
Although I am kind of ecumenical. I pretty much like anything if it's in the place where it's supposed to be.
Exactly. You know? Right. I feel exactly the same.
Yeah. So in addition to this sort of more general food writing, which you're known for, I guess, everywhere, in Charleston, you're known very well as a restaurant critic.
Yeah.
And, you know, a restaurant critic who is obviously well-known and maybe a little notorious among the chefs of Charleston. I know the last thing that happened that I know of is that you got banned from reviewing a restaurant, even entering it, before it even opened. Is that right?
That's correct.
So kind of tell the story of what happened there.
Sure. So what happened in that case, and I'll try to make it as compact as possible, a pair of restaurant owners who had previously opened a wine bar and then another little French restaurant, which I had reviewed upon opening and liked it very much, as it was a very, very positive review. But in that review, again, positive review, and I should know how many stars I gave it, but it was far more than I usually dole out. But in that review, I pointed out a number of things that I thought would be of interest to my audience, which, as I think you said earlier, is a general audience. And I know you're a newspaper man yourself, so you know, that you are serving multitudes, who have all sorts of concerns. And so I thought it was relevant to point out that this restaurant doesn't have a sign and you can't see it from the street. And if you go out and map it, you may get frustrated. And the menu is written in the chef's personal eccentric script, and you can't really read the menu. And there's only
it sounds like one of those places they really don't want you to come there.
Yeah, well, Well, and clearly they didn't want me to come there and make a point of it. But so that's what I was trying to convey. It's like, look, you know, they really know how to, you know, cook a chicken breast or whatever, but chicken's what you're having because there's only two dishes every day. And if you're vegetarian, that's your bad luck. So again, knowing my audience includes people who may be of, you know, limited eyesight or just of, you know, just tend to get exasperated quickly, I felt like it was better to bring these things up at the start before afflicting these people upon the restaurant. So apparently the restaurant owners were not too pleased by that. They didn't like these things pointed out, which continues to confound me. I feel like you can make any choice you want as a restaurant owner. I prefer it when you own that decision, you know, and say, well, this is what we do. So prior to them opening a new little Spanish tapas place, they sent me an email explaining that if I were to show up at this place, that it would be a scene and I was not welcome there and I could not come in. And so it was a real conundrum. It was really interesting, not because I so wanted to go to this place necessarily, but it was certainly a splashy restaurant that people around town were talking about. And that's, you know, one of the critics' most important functions is to sort of, you know, guide that conversation or at least contribute to it in some way. So it was really tricky. And additionally, if I were to set the precedent that a restaurant was to say, you can't review us and I would comply, that becomes really difficult. So I had to do something. And so initially I thought, well, you know, I'll just send someone in the office over for to-go orders and I'll just deal with it that way. I'll just imagine that I'd gone to the place. But they didn't do to-go orders because, as I said in my review of the first restaurant, they aren't incredibly accommodating. So they don't do that. So what I ended up doing, and I considered all sorts of things. I'm friends with a rabbi. I thought, you know, if I walked in with a member of the clergy, would they kick me out? I didn't like the idea of going in disguise. It just seemed overly sneaky. I also didn't want to just explicitly, you know, violate their request because in some ways it seemed like a setup. They were sort of asking me to create that scene and I didn't want to do so. So what I ended up doing was friends went for dinner and they brought me their leftovers. And that's what I ended up writing about.
And I guess, first of all, I want to, because I think this is something that I'm not even sure still happens with restaurant critics and things. You're picture doesn't appear in the paper, does it?
It does not.
But I suspect that all the restaurant people in Charleston who've been there for a while, they probably know what you look like.
They definitely do. It's a small town and a small paper, so I function as reporter as well. So it's not like I can be a complete recluse.
Right. And I guess we should add the layer on top of that for those who don't know that Charleston is a huge restaurant town and a place where people come there and visit just to eat. And so I guess those, you know, the restaurants there carry maybe more importance than they would in some other place, like Charlotte, for example.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to make. I mean, it's interesting to see that stories that I write, not because it's anything to do with my writing, but because of the what I'm covering. We'll have more people. We had more people reading food stories the night before Clemson was playing for the championship. I mean, I think that tells you everything about where priorities in Charleston lie.
I have to say that's quite a stat.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want to kind of put that in the context of, you know, I wonder about the tide you're fighting against, because I know a lot of the food stuff I see online now is sort of, you know, this generated by interns and college students and stuff, you know, the 10 best pizzas in this town or whatever. And a lot of, obviously, sort of the crowdsourced, the Yelp and TripAdvisor and all those sorts of things, where you often get either very boosterish stuff or you get people just totally trashing stuff and, you know, and not giving any account anything that might be good. I wonder how you're threading that needle there as a restaurant critic in a place where everybody feels like now they can be a restaurant critic.
And I kind of think they can too. Like, I'm a big proponent of Yelp and all that.
I wrote a book about it.
Yeah, I think it's a great platform. Like, I don't think Yelp on its own has some questionable business practices, and I don't want to stand up for the way Yelp deals with restaurants, and I understand there have been accusations of shakedowns and all that. But the way that the consumer interacts with Yelp, I think it's a really promising platform, and I don't think it in any way inhibits critical thinking. I mean, that lies with the person, not the platform. So I think the idea that it empowers people to think big thoughts and share them with others in their community, those are things I'm really behind.
So what do you see as your role sort of separate from or in the context of all that?
Yeah, so I think my role is, first of all, I mean, it gives people, I provide a consistent voice, which you can't often find on Yelp. You don't know who these people are. People know who I am, kind of what I think, where I've been. So I think that provides a sense of stability that a site like Yelp does not. And two, it's my job to contextualize what we're eating, why we're eating it, and to get into the whole broad, you know, sweep of culinary history, which, if I saw in a Yelp review, I probably would be the only one skipping over it. I mean, that's really not the time and place for it.
Your role beyond that is more of a food writer, writing about trends and issues and things like the Hatch story.
Yeah.
What do you see your role as there?
It's the same idea. I mean, these things are kind of interwoven. So, you know, I mean, the idea where we started at the beginning to say it was in Rodney Scott's where I got to think about Hash. I mean, you know, the past and present are always in conversation. And so for now, you know, as we have a slew of new barbecue places, this is a way to kind of ground people, so many of whom in Charleston are arriving from elsewhere, in what our region's traditions are. So I think it just makes people more informed consumers when they walk into this dazzling restaurant scene we have in Charleston.
So John T. Edge was a guest on our podcast, I think close to the beginning. And I think I asked him some version of this question because obviously he spent his life, as you know, in the Southern Foodways Alliance, thinking about all the things you're just talking about. Can you have a meal and not think about it? Like, can a pork chop just be a pork chop?
I'm curious what John T. said. Let's see. Yes. I mean, I think there are meals that, I mean, they are just so emotional that they are not cerebral, I think. And so you can have an experience that isn't going to be placing it in the context of history. Sure, I think that's possible. It would be very strange for me to have a meal and not have any reaction, either body or mind.
It does strike me, just as you said that such a part of what we think of when we have a meal somewhere is like who we're having it with.
Yeah.
You know, our friends or family members or something, some restaurant that might not be that great, but it's, you know, where you got engaged or
yes,
whatever it was.
Yes.
And I guess you're kind of, the way you have to do your job is a little detached from that, right?
I suppose it is. I mean, I can't fault the chef if nobody proposes to me at the table, you know, like, really, like, so yeah, I know that I am in a very contrived and fabricated situation, but what I will say is I am constantly trying to remind readers, at least subtly so, that food is not all that the restaurant experience is about. In fact, it's probably one of the smaller parts. I mean, obviously, these new delivery services have done really, really well, but they haven't wiped out all the restaurants yet because we're going there for things other than food.
When we come back, Hannah Raskin talks about how the coronavirus affects one of America's wonders, the seafood buffets at Myrtle Beach. That and more ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
If you're enjoying today's Southbound and are craving even more stories about the South, then I highly recommend a podcast called Gravy. It's from the Southern Foodways Alliance, an organization at the University of Mississippi that uses food as a lens to tell larger stories. narratives about lionfish, open conversations about environmental change, invasive species, and creative problem solving. Or the tale of a barbecue pitmaster prompts an examination of regional traditions, race, and economy. It's good stuff, y'all. Find Gravy on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and your favorite podcast app. And now, back to our conversation with Hannah Raskin. So you wrote something just recently in the last day or two about the coronavirus, which everybody, of course, is looking for some kind of angle on. And yours was really interesting and something I had not thought about, how it might affect the buffet business.
Yeah, I mean, as your listeners may know, buffets are integral to the Myrtle Beach area along the Grand Strand. And so it occurred to me, you know, as we were talking about the dangers posed by cruise ships and people quarantined them on them, you know, if there's anything that traditionally makes a cruise dangerous, it's the buffet. We know that scientifically that this is, it's a great place for germs just to thrive. Buffets can be questionable places. I personally love buffets, like really unironically love buffets. I have a big appetite. I like all kinds of food. It's kind of made for me. I always get my money's worth at a buffet. So I was very concerned about our folks to the north. And I had this image of, I mean, if your listeners haven't been to the buffets in Myrtle Beach, they are enormous.
They're spectacular.
They are incredible. And there's Captain George's has like a boat built into the ceiling. I mean, these are, and they have like these light shows going on. One of the ones that I interviewed an owner from has 1,000 seats, and they turn those tables more than once over the course of a night. So we're talking about, even if you've seen the buffets in Vegas, you ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, these places are incredible. And so I had this sad vision of just, you know, buffet as far as the eye can see and not a person in it. I called up and I'm happy to say I was totally wrong. The buffets are doing great.
Now, do you think that's because people just aren't buying that this is a big deal or what?
So I think there are a couple of things. I think one, as I said at the outset, buffets do have not a great reputation. So I think if you already love buffets, you're going to keep loving buffets.
What the hell?
What's a little more coronavirus, right? They're dealing with everything else. So I think that's part of it. What the owner said, and I buy into this a little bit, which is that because of that reputation, they're already taking a ton of health precautions. So unlike, you know, if you went into like your local burger place, you might do a double take if all the servers were wearing gloves and, you know, but at a buffet, it's expected. It's expected that there's a hand sanitizer station all the way through the dining room. Whereas, again, if you went into some fancy restaurant, you saw that, you'd think like, oh, I don't know about this place. But a buffet is already doing everything it can to keep their folks healthy and safe.
So Hannah, how did you get into all this? Or were you interested in food since the time you were a little kid? I mean, more than most people are.
Yeah. I think I've always been a good eater, if that's what you're asking. Like, I was
big sleeper, good eater. Clean plate club,
for sure. Yeah. And more so than that, although I didn't remember this until I was well into this profession, when I turned, let's say, 9 or 10, I had asked for my birthday party to have a chocolate chip cookie tasting party.
Oh, man.
I was, at the time, I used to love when my parents' issue of Consumer Reports would arrive. I wanted to review something, and so we had all the chocolate chip cookies. It's actually a great idea for a party. You know, you get a $2 box of cookies or whatever. And I think this too proved not only that I was interested in food and interested in criticizing it, but I was going to be tough enough to be in journalism because my mother contributed cookies, and we rated those dead last.
Oh, man.
Yep.
I'm sure that's still a topic of discussion in your family.
Of course. Yeah. She doesn't like it because when people ask how I got into this, I always say, well, my mother wasn't a good cook. And she says, could you please stop saying that? So I'm not going to say that on your podcast. I'm not going to say that.
No, well, I'm glad you did. Yeah. So at what point did this sort of become something you figured out you could do as a profession?
Like sort of in the back of my mind, I kind of knew it existed. I do remember when I was in high school. So I'm, how old am I? Well, I graduated in in 94. So I remember sending off a letter to Jane and Michael Stern asking if they'd thought about a succession plan. So
Jane
I
and
was
Michael
a,
Stern being the road food. Yeah.
So I clearly was aware that there was a living to be made in traveling to places and eating folk food, which I have somehow now done for a living, which is really kind of incredible. But kind of put that aside and didn't do anything in the food writing realm for quite some time. I went into daily newspapers right out of college, not the kind that had any sort of food coverage. My first job was at the Commercial Dispatch in Columbus, Mississippi. So I started there, went out to Tucson, worked at the morning daily there, and then got tired of newspapers because, like I said, I was young, still young, but I had a big ego, and I was really sad that I would write something and then it was gone because this is before the internet was like a real working thing. And so I went to museum school thinking I could do the same kind of stories. And I put them on the wall and they would stay there for a year. That was pretty much my idea. I had no idea what I was getting into. And it turned out when I went to this program for American History Museum Studies, very specific, it was not for me. If you're used to the deadline structure of being a newspaper reporter, museums are a tough, tough place.
Because your deadline is, what, 2 years from now?
Yeah, exactly. I'm talking in terms of years. And again, if you've worked in a newspaper, that is unheard of. Yeah. You know, so.
At what point did that become, do you kind of turn back toward food and writing about food?
So there I am in grad school realizing I don't want to do what I'm about to get a degree in. So fortunately, as I said, it was this double master's program, American History and Museum Studies. And for my American history, for my thesis, for my master's, I wrote out in the relationship between Jews and Chinese food. And now everybody knows about so-called Jewish Christmas. But then it was like totally undocumented. And so it was really fun, as you remember, like food writing and all of this as a discipline really was like food history was just coming up as you know, something people could study and talk about. And so I got to know all these food people kind of right off the bat just because I was working in this arena. That's about the time I met John T, I think. So I got the idea that food was a thing you could think about and write about. But like I said, I now had this degree that I didn't know what to do with. And so I used it to I moved to Asheville and I led mountain bike trips. And so that's what I was doing, biking in Asheville. And like everyone in Asheville, just working a ton of jobs, including waitressing, which is really whenever anyone asks me how to become a food writer, I always tell them to get a job as a waitress or waiter, server.
Why is that?
Because you will never learn better how to describe food than when your paycheck depends on it. And if you can say, if you can explain why that special is worth buying, you know, and it's $20 more than anything else on the menu, you just made $5. So there's a real economic incentive to, you know, get good with your food words. So, yes, I worked at the Inn and Biltmore Estate. I worked Jack of the Wood. I worked all over Asheville. And so did all that, as well as everything else. Like I said, it's Asheville, so I'm teaching fitness classes, selling wedding dresses. I did the whole gambit. But the Alt Weekly was looking for writers. And like I said, I had the writing background. So I started freelancing over there. And when they were wanting to add a food section, I said, I might know something about that.
And you talk about food history.
Yeah.
Now, besides your mom's chocolate chip cookies, you grew up in Michigan, is that right?
I did, yep.
So what's your family food history or what, you know, what kind of stuff did you grow up eating?
So Zingerman's opened in Ann Arbor, where I lived when I was pretty young. And that's the most formative thing. So this is important. Like, my most formative food experiences, and this is actually true for my parents as well, were restaurants. I mean, we really did not have a strong home cooking tradition. My mother worked, and again, she always likes me to mention that it wasn't that she was a bad cook. She was a inspirational working woman.
I was going to say, I like the way you phrase that. We didn't have a strong home cooking tradition.
Right, we did not. So there are no great cooks in my family. I think, you know, my grandparents, everyone was just so happy to to be done with the old country, that it's like, if you can order food, that seems like a great deal. So it's just, it was not a cooking family, but restaurants were incredibly important. And like I said, going back, Zingerman's, which now has a, you know, like a global mail order business.
Right, the legendary deli in Ann Arbor.
Exactly right. So it's a deli that opened, I can't think of the exact year, but they used to put out these catalogs, because it's not just a deli, although they make some of the world's finest sandwiches. I mean, incredible sandwiches. Not only that, but it was a deli more in lines with like what people think of as like the old Dean and DeLuca model, right? Where you can buy fine olive oils and great jams. And it was a whole kind of a very extensive pantry section. And the reason I'm saying all this is every month they'd sort of put out a catalog about all their finds. And that was the first food writing I was ever exposed to. And I remember going as a little girl to the deli, which in itself was important, but also to read those catalogs and to read what really was food writing.
So you grew up, spent the time in Michigan, but since then you lived in Mississippi, Texas, I believe, North and both Carolinas. Do you feel Southern
at all?
You've
missed a bunch of stuff.
Well, I was talking about just in the South. Have you lived...
Right. Mississippi, Carolinas, Texas.
Yeah. So have you ever felt, or do you currently feel Southern? Or let me rephrase it. When do you feel the most Southern?
Great question. I suppose oftentimes when I'm talking to someone who most certainly is Southern and I feel like I'm fluent in the language they're speaking. That's when you feel, and that's what you hear about, right? When people move off to other countries and they get really excited the night they have a dream in Russian or Polish or whatever, you know, it's that same feeling where it's like, you know, the rhythms and, you know, the jokes. Like, I think that's probably when you feel the most at home.
I know this is happening here and probably is happening in other places too. There's this push and pull, similar to what I was talking about with sort of restaurant criticism. There's this push to do things faster, more conveniently. You know, there's all these places now that will bring food to your door, kind of the DoorDash model and that sort of thing. But there's also this pull in the other direction to go slower, more authentic, use homegrown ingredients, more organic things and that sort of thing. Do you feel like in the South that we're kind of pulling in both those directions too? And is either side kind of winning it all?
Oh, interesting question. I might dispute that dichotomy just a bit, as
okay.
to say. I mean, I understand the proud agrarian tradition of the South, and I think that's really important. But I don't want to reject some of the quicker things that are a little bit processed, that those things can be authentic too. We talked about the buffets earlier, right?
Sure.
And I just think that's such a part of the culture. And so I guess what I'm saying is I sometimes get concerned, especially here living in Charleston, where tourists come looking for a very specific food experience, that some of the things which really define people's life and define the culinary culture are not those things that are easy to romanticize. And I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But it's that middle that I sometimes worry gets overlooked when we talk about the push and the pull.
Well, it is funny. I've told this story to other folks. I grew up in the coast of Georgia. And when shrimp and grits started to become a big thing in Charleston 20 years ago, however long that was, it was just a hilarious joke in our family. Because in our family, shrimp and grits is what you ate if there was nothing left in the house.
Right.
And so to see something that came from such a humble background, at least in my experience, become this sort of signature, almost a delicacy in Charleston and other places, part of me thinks that's really funny, but part of me also is kind of proud of that. Because that's where, you know, that tradition comes from, when people have made it into something special.
Yes. Yeah, right.
And I guess barbecue is sort of the same way, right?
For sure, right? Yeah. And that's an interesting journey. So, I mean, so maybe that is just the ongoing, that trajectory, that push and pull. I think it is fun to watch these things go back and forth. But yeah, I guess I just wanted to dispute the extremes, right?
Well, I do totally understand. I think I was thinking about grits, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, I love grits.
Yeah.
But I ain't cooking the, like, 2 hour long grits.
Right.
You know?
Right.
The
right.
ones you have
right.
to stir forever.
Right.
I'm not making the instant either.
Mm-hmm.
But there's
mm-hmm.
the quick grits in the middle.
Right.
The ones you stir for 5 or 10 minutes.
Right.
I'll make that all day.
Yeah.
And it's good, and it's good enough.
Right. Right, 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 right. And to me, that's kind of where the South lies. That's where most of the folks are at. Like, if you go up north, they're going to buy their grits from Anson Mills here, and they're going to cook them all day long, which is great, you know. Or, you know, you can see somebody who's buying grits, not because they love grits, say somebody out in a, you know, apartment in Colorado, they just buy the instant. They don't really care. But it's finding that middle. I feel like that's how you know you're really in the South.
I love how Hannah Raskin said she's been in the South long enough that the language has become natural to her. We're not always kind to outsiders down here. More than anything, our food has been our welcome mat. Even if something like barbecue hash is an acquired taste, it's welcome for anyone to acquire. And once you understand what it is and where it comes from, you understand this part of the world a little better. That's one of the things food does for us. It's a translator, a way to bridge the gaps among people who might have a hard time understanding one another. And it's also a way, in these uncertain times, to make anywhere feel like home. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audio engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.